Three friends.
Three cities.
One question.
How can we turn this world around?
You're on with Earth Friends. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Do I say hi to? Hello.
Okay, great. And just like that, we are on episode 3, Rise and Grind. Let's get this existential dread featuring the one and only Tara Santos.
Woohoo!
I'm super excited for this episode since I've known Tara since high school. She is super active and I love learning from her posts and Extinction Rebellion about the state of the Philippines and even in the US and just everything that's going on in the world with the current events. Another great source for me personally. But aside from that, she is the national coordinator of Extinction Rebellion's Philippine chapter. And Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to persuade governments to act on the climate crisis. Apart from that, and the work that she does with the organization, she's also deeply passionate about reducing plastic pollution and has done extensive research within the space. And then a little fun fact, she also, maybe you'll hear it in this episode, has one of the most distinct laughs I think I've ever heard.
You probably will.
Welcome, Tara.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. We start with all our episodes. We want to ask you, so what has impacted you this week?
I recently watched the documentary on Netflix called Seaspiracy. It was done by the same people who made the documentary Cowspiracy, which is more about meat. Oh. Yeah, the meat and dairy industry. So but this one talks about the fishing industry specifically. They talk mainly about if there really is a true sustainable way to fish. But my problem with the argument of not eating meat or not eating seafood is that it kind of just erases a lot of the culture. For example, in the Philippines, it erases a lot of culture because a lot of people cannot afford to cut out dairy or cut out dairy, meat, and fish, especially when you're talking about places like the Philippines.
Oh my gosh, I'm so happy you brought that up because I think that part of the argument there, even in Cowspiracy, is lacking. In a class I took in college, that was one of the questions I think I thought about most, was just like, or just having options in general is something that you can do when you have privilege. And Nikki and I were talking about this earlier, where having options comes from privilege. And meat is cheaper in the Philippines, fish as well. Like, there's not many alternatives for the most marginalized people in the country. So kind of where there's this huge disconnect, right? And we don't know exactly how to kind of bridge that gap.
It's an easy way to get protein.
Yeah, exactly. And even another, like, I guess one of, like, my main problem with the whole, like, going vegan argument or going vegetarian argument is that a lot of, I don't think there's inherently anything wrong with eating meat or fish or dairy. I think it's just the industries and how we're exploiting our environment to get all of this. Yeah. And obviously that comes with the demand, like the increase in demand for all of these things. But if you think about, let's say, like the indigenous groups in the Philippines who hunt as a part of their culture, and when you say that the only way we can, or one of the main ways we can solve the climate crisis is to beyond beef our way or beyond meat our way out of it, does not make sense to me.
It has to be in the context of the local situation. Like if beyond meat took like how many thousands of miles to get to you, I mean, it's just probably as bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I had the same dilemma, I think, last year. I started this campaign with For the Future with Christelle Torres called the Rainbow Plate. So it's like a healthy diet is like a healthy is a healthy environment. And we spoke to this chef that does a lot of food programs locally, and they were asking for his advice on like the best like solutions to have a good diet with local produce and stuff. And he put us in check. Like, he was like, how can you have everyone focus on having a healthy diet now at this point in a pandemic, when the problem now is actually giving food to people? So it was hard to kind of like find that balance between giving solutions for a healthy diet and also like finding solutions to feed people. So I super get that.
Yeah, I think whenever in general, when you're ingesting any type of resource or information, there's always it's always important to have a critical lens and not just believe everything 100%. Because we were talking about Beyond Meat and Impossible Beef in our first episode and how we've been able to try it, but it's not, you're exactly right. I don't think it's about switching out all of your meat, because there's this whole issue about alternatives as well. Like, I think everything just needs to be balanced.
Because I know the argument is really when not eating meat is reducing your carbon footprint, right? Because a lot of meat requires a lot of energy, also takes up a lot of land.
Yeah.
What people don't recognize is that it's only, I think, 9 companies that are responsible for, I think, more than 70% of our global emissions. And one of them is BP, like British Petroleum. And they came up with the concept of the carbon footprint. So, you know, everyone's talking about reduce your carbon footprint when a fossil fuel company, a gas company, is the one who came up with it, kind of as a way to, I call it, it's greenwashing, really. They make you focus on your carbon footprint so you don't focus on theirs.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
No, I think I read something about that, yeah.
Yeah, it came out in a campaign in, like, 2003.
Oh.
And BP would actually, I think in their earlier days, I saw an ad that they came out with, and they were showing off how they were able to, like, melt all these glaciers. And they were like, yeah, we're able to provide this much energy. And it shows by, look at how much the glaciers were able to melt.
No way.
Are you serious?
I'll try to find the ad. But yeah, someone sent it to me and I was like, is this real? It was.
So, like, how can we be more aware of when a brand falls privy to greenwashing?
I think, one, it really depends on the industry you're in. But what I like to call it the most is, one, the, like, fossil fuel companies. If you go on any of their social media pages, their bios will always say supplying the world with their energy needs while still addressing the needs of the climate crisis. When they actually spend over, like, I think, actually, it depends on the company, but they spend billions in lobbying against climate change efforts while they're also establishing climate change initiatives when they actually are fighting against it. So it does not make sense. Like the COP conference that the one that Greta usually speaks at, the one that's hosted by the United Nations, is funded by Big Oil. So my friend was talking of, she was interviewed by another one of my friends. She was saying how it really doesn't make sense that at conferences like COP, you have Big Oil representatives speaking or funding it, because you question why we aren't getting any real change in terms of, like, legislation, things like that, when it's because they're really paying for it to not happen.
Oh, gosh.
You guys want to learn more about it? My friend started, like, an organization called Polluters Out, and they tried to get, like, dirty banks and dirty companies out of, like, these conferences.
Oh, was it called again? Polluters Out?
Yeah, Polluters Out. I think it was in 2019 where they actually striked and got, like, kicked out of, like, the entrance of where the thing was, of where the conference was.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely add that and send it so everyone that's listening can learn more about it. But so the example, the company that you listed, right, they're all Big Oil, but let's say on a day-to-day basis for the products we kind of consume more regularly, I guess, as younger individuals, let's say, especially if you live independently, right, and get to make those choices for your household, from cleaning products, even now apparel, how do you get to distinguish the difference between, like, okay, this is something cool that this company is doing versus this is all BS? Is what they're doing actually genuine? Is it real? Does it really make a difference? Or is it
making an impact? Yeah.
I think one of the easiest and most direct ways is, well, what I do is I actually ask, like, oh, what other sustainable things are you doing? If it's like a fashion company, let's say, if they're only coming out with one sustainable collection, and everything else is made out of, like, fossil fuel based plastic, so that's nylon, polyester, whatever, then that also does not equal sustainability. And also, for a lot of like sustainable fashion brands, let's say, you know, everyone is like, oh, it's made out of recycled plastic.
Yeah.
You think it'd be a good thing, but actually those kinds of clothes, it reduces one problem and creates another, because when you wash clothes and if they're still made out of plastic, the microfibers still get released. And what's harder to clean up from the ocean? Microfibers or a plastic bottle that, you know what I mean, that can be recycled and upcycled into something else that won't break down into microplastics in the ocean, like clothes would. Well, for fashion companies too, sorry, like a lot of the greenwashing I try to call out is like fashion companies. I always look at their like labor practices. I always look at the like the influencers they're supporting.
That's a good one.
Yeah, because if like the same influencer is posting about Unilever, then there's a conflict of interest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When Unilever is one of the top plastic polluters in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of Unilever, actually, like one of the annoying marketing posts that I've seen like last year was their metal straw in their milk tea, Nestea milk tea.
Oh yeah.
But the sachet is like right beside it. So I'm like, are you trying to be like eco-friendly here, or are you like trying to rub it in that you guys use sachets until now? Actually, speaking about plastics, my foot in the door with sustainability actually started with plastics, and it only started when I began working like 4 years ago or 3 years ago. And it really amazes me that so little is done when so much can be recycled. Like, I mean, I know only 9% is recycled all over the world, but it starts with like segregating. Like once you segregate it, you find like value in it, and it turns into like amazing things. Like companies in the Philippines, like Green Ants, like they turn it into like actual eco bricks, or like PLAF, you know, Plastic Flamingo, like they turn it into like eco lumbers. And I don't know, what's your take on it, and how does it like, how did it start with you?
I think that with plastic pollution, I took a class on plastic in, I think, my junior year of college. And I remember getting really pissed off in that class because one of the things we're talking about was the whole like water bottle argument. And a lot of, because this was in the States, right? So everyone was like, oh, I just don't understand why people can't just bring their like clean canteen or like reusable water bottles around and refill it. And I'm like, well, that's in the States where you can just get, or in New York where you can get clean water from the tap. And places like the Philippines, we don't even have proper like filtering services, so that's why we have to rely on plastic. And then after that, that's when I start to get into like the more social side of plastic pollution, especially in the context of like solutions that are presented by Western media, because it's like we can't, like, us switching from plastic straws to metal straws won't really make a difference when like the top plastic that we have in the ocean now is like from fishing. I think it's over 50%.
No way.
Yeah. Well, that's just from the organization that I work with. They're called Project Aware.
Yeah.
They basically just get a bunch of divers from around the world, and you have to, whatever trash you clean up, and it has to be the ones that are already underwater. They don't count the ones that are floating for some reason, but you have to count.
Why?
You have to count. Yeah, I think it's because when they talk about marine waste, they're really talking about like what's been there for a long time now, I guess. I don't know. But then, so all of these divers from around the world just basically submit their data. And after that, like every year they come out with a report saying, oh, all these divers reported X amount of plastic and they fall into these categories. And for the past few years, it's been fishing gear.
Oh.
Yeah. So with plastic pollution, I think learning about that's when I started to really get into, okay, so what are actual things that people can do, and especially in the context of the Philippines, that will actually make a difference. Because we don't have recycling, we don't even have proper management for waste in general. A lot of it really, I think, just came from that conversations I had, especially in the States, and also because I dive, right? And I've been diving for 10 years now, and the amount of trash I've seen has been increasing every year. And so seeing it firsthand, plus coral bleaching, that really obviously made me sad. It pissed me off. Yeah. So with that whole argument, like what you were saying earlier about like recycling, a part of my thesis actually, so my thesis was about plastic pollution in the Philippines. There's this one author, her name is Samantha McBride, and she actually talks about how recycling doesn't make sense. And it's kind of like a way for companies to put the blame on the consumer and governments rather than themselves, because it still allows them to produce the same amount of plastic.
It seems like all of the issues that are being pointed out stem from the bigger players in the industry or in business. And on an individual basis, while smaller actionable changes still make a difference, it's not enough. That being said, so with Extinction Rebellion, right? I know that the whole point is to get government agencies and larger corporations moving. So can you kind of talk a little bit more about the work that you're doing with the Philippine context or even any of your colleagues in different chapters? Because I'm sure people will be curious to kind of hear more about that side too.
Well, with XR, so it started in the UK and I first joined XR in the States. So XR Universities US, that was like the first and only physical action that I've done. And that's what XR is known for, like physical actions, going in front of banks and having these big performances. But because of the pandemic and also because of the terror law, XR Philippines had to tone it down a little bit. So a lot of our presence is digital. And so what we tried to do with XR is that we tried to find projects or issues that are going on, and we usually run a digital campaign on it. And usually we'll do like webinars so more people can learn other sustainable alternatives. And then we try to go directly to whatever company or government agency is responsible for it. Mm-hmm. So for example, the last campaign we did was for Kalewa Dam, which has actually been in construction proposed since the time of Marcos, which I did not know until starting that campaign.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I thought it was recent, but it's been going on for such a long time.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So we partnered with the Stop Kalewa Dam Network. So WWF, Harry Bond Foundation, they're part of that. And Project 19 Eco, where they're a youth-based org that focuses on like a green recovery from COVID. So we partnered for this campaign. And basically what WWF was saying to us is that even if we tried to go directly to the DNR, let's say, they never listen. So unlike the States, where you could like really get a lot of people to, I don't know, like email spam someone for them to like, okay, let's have a meeting. It's impossible to do that in the Philippines. That's why it's harder. And so a lot of it, for me at least, is a lot of it is really just like education. That's what I try to do with XR, since we can't be as direct in terms of persuading governments to act, especially when it's dangerous.
Yeah.
So like a lot of your work involves gathering like communities under the same advocacy. That's one of the things that I've seen. I've seen a TED talk of someone from Harlem that explained what XR was, and it's really a non-violent approach towards getting governments to listen to the climate crisis and to see with their own eyes that, you know, this is a problem that can't be like taken away. And it's just sad, especially now with the terror bill in the Philippines, like, and with the whole pandemic, we can't rally and do the same things that the people in the US are doing with their advocacies. Mm-hmm. So with that, like, it's really like youth activism now in the 21st century is really like a digital campaign towards getting people to
get honestly, on that train. Yeah. Sometimes it becomes almost like a toxic environment because everything is online now. So I feel like one is information overload. Well, for some people, I feel like it becomes like a game almost. Or when you see people who are like almost celebrity status, and not talking about real issues or not amplifying voices of people who are being affected the most by the climate crisis, then that's when I start to question it. Because I remember even being in XR meetings for like the New York group.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying that, oh, we should have a campaign on people in like affected areas. But instead of doing like a campaign on that, they were like, oh, we're going to turn fountains in New York red because it's going to get more media attention. So I'm like, what has more impact? You guys turning fountains red in New York and getting an article, or actually educating people about what's actually happening in their climate crisis?
The analysis can't just be online with number of likes and reach and all of that. It should actually be like impact on ground, which is really like hard to do right now when, you know, things are all online. Like I've recently heard the term doom scrolling, which happened quite a lot during the pandemic, like with a lot of the things that have happened, and we were just stuck at home, like with the terror bill, with everything. Like there was so much, and it was like a sizable amount of people or number of people that have been sharing the same posts. And I don't know, like it kind of takes a toll on you when you're scrolling. It's like hard to find the balance between getting people to like believe in your cause and like not being too in your face, because if you're too in your face, like people will just like scroll away, and that's really an issue that like activists now have to like balance out.
Yeah. I think the key really is connecting with the people. So mm-hmm. my goal with XR wasn't to cater to like these white activists or these white people who are trying to get into the environmental movement. It's mm-hmm. more really just to educate Filipinos, right? Because I feel like we're very detached from this and we're not seeing how it affects us. So for example, like when temperatures were changing, when it got really cold and no media or no news outlet was talking about how it's related to the climate crisis, I was getting so pissed off because after the typhoons we went through last year, you'd think that they'd be more direct about the climate crisis, but we're not.
So I was going to ask you more about, I think you're in a unique position to be able to get educated in the West and then now move home and bring those two worlds together and put that into action. But I remember reading on one of your posts that about like environmental racism, which was a term or concept I wasn't really familiar with or exposed to prior. So I don't think a lot of the headlines kind of talk about that, or it's like a smaller subsection of the climate crisis.
I guess I'll start off with like the how I learned about it. The example that was given to me in class was actually in Newark in New Jersey. So a lot of the people who are living in Newark are African-Americans, right? But that's where a lot of the factories live. Yeah. So when talking about environmental racism, a lot of these factories or industry buildings are literally where they live. And because it's where they live, that's usually the form of like employment that they go towards. And usually these have really bad like health effects. So like from pollution, things like that. When you're making plastic, it really affects your endocrine system. And in the Philippines, for example, if you're using the same example, in Valenzuela, that's where we produce a lot of our plastics. And nobody talks about how people there are actually getting really sick because they have to close all. They're basically breathing in all of these fumes from these factories. And that's what causes, causes a lot of lung cancer, things like that. And so when you're talking about like pipelines are being built, usually where communities of color live. And even, so I was working or I was on a meeting with the Climate Change Commission of the Philippines, and they were talking about, you know, making the switch to renewable energy. And I asked them, so where are you guys planning to have these plants? Like, where are you guys planning to set up all these things? And usually it's where minorities live.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked like, okay, so what are you going to do with the people who live there? And they could not answer because I think, I don't know, they just don't care. And that's the sad reality of it. It's like usually, well, that's how I understand it. It's usually
the poorest communities.
Yeah, the poorest communities who are being affected the most. Yeah.
The most,
And then on the other side of that, there was an incident that happened. I can't remember her name was Vanessa. She's a climate activist from, I think, I can't remember what country in Africa, but she was in a conference with Greta and two or three other white activists, and they were all doing the same work, but a lot of news outlets, they cut her out of the picture as if the only activists that mattered were the white ones.
Oh, wow.
That's
So there's that in terms of like the actual environmental racism in terms of where things are being, where plants, where plants are being built, where pipelines are being built. And then there's also in terms of representation. And also when you think about big players or big activists in the environmental sphere, it's David Attenborough, Greta Thunberg, Leonardo DiCaprio, and they're all white. When a lot of people of color have been doing this work and actually fighting for their people who are going through it firsthand. Like Leonardo DiCaprio, I'm pretty sure has not gone through an intense flood where, you know what I mean? Neither has Greta.
Like what he had in his documentary.
So I think that's where like we have to be more critical, because I remember seeing this video of Greta saying like, we need to plant more trees and that's the solution to the climate crisis. And I was like, girl, do you know how long it takes to plant a tree? People are dying now.
Exactly. Social justice is really like intrinsically related to the climate crisis.
Okay, so what do you think about Greta Thunberg crossing the ocean in a sailboat? What are your thoughts? on that?
Borderline greenwashing or?
No, because, okay, I don't want to discredit the work she does because she does really good work. But I think that the amount of work and the effect she has is a lot of it has to do with her whiteness. If a for example, a Black activist did that, media would not be on them the same amount as Greta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, like I have a friend, her name is Disha V, and she was, oh my God, she was arrested by the Indian government for making this toolkit for the farmers' protest.
And
when that happened, no, in India. In India. And so when that happened, a lot of conversation was coming up. Like for every, my friend said something along the lines of, for every activist with like a blue check mark, for every Greta Thunberg, there's a Disha Ravi who's been working on this design and is actually doing it for people. They do not have a blue check mark. They don't have more than 10,000 followers, but they're doing real work. And that's just as important as the stuff that Greta is doing. So yeah, when you compare like Greta crossing the ocean in a sailboat versus people here, for example, environmental lawyers being shot, like who's doing the real work and for which people, the people who are being affected the most by the climate crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess it also has a little like, it has an upside too that the media is picking up on these initiatives rather than keeping it as the corner or the CSR or like the eco-friendly part that's actually making headlines. So but yeah, I really agree, like being on ground is just as hard if not harder, because you have to really suck in the realities of it. It's not just something that you read about. I was talking to Isa Barte, so she's one of the co-founders of For the Future, and she recently went on a month and a half long immersion to different communities in, I think, Bicol and the northern parts of the Philippines. And it takes a toll. Like, it's hard to do the work you're doing and knowing it's still not enough to help them get by. And I mean, those are the things that are not picked up by the media, but they're just as relevant and should be relevant. So,
I guess bringing it back to more of, or transitioning into more of actionable things that we can do or that we can be more involved in. I know that one of the things that we were talking about earlier in another episode was talking about education, right? Like, you've mentioned it yourself, how important it is to raise awareness, to educate ourselves, and to kind of take on that responsibility. One thing that we three were talking about too was that this should start at an earlier age so that this consciousness and this mindset is instilled when you're younger. And we know that you've been giving talks to little students, so we wanted to kind of learn more about that experience and how you frame that conversation.
Yeah, so it actually really surprised me because they're really aware of these issues. They're aware about plastic pollution. Like when you go into the Q&A section, they're like, oh yeah, this time I was at the beach, I picked up all of this stuff, la 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 la. So they're actually really aware of it. What they aren't aware of is how it relates, how it relates to climate change, because they see plastic pollution as just like this one singular thing. And my role is kind of bringing it back to the climate crisis and how that's related to the storms that we've been experiencing in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And like for the first talk that I did, I didn't use as much visuals, which my fault, but they're really able to understand it when I was like, oh, so plastic comes from fossil fuels cause like emissions. And then I talk about the greenhouse gas effect and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you kind of link those things together and when they can see it and when they've seen it themselves and when they go to the beach, they see all this plastic, they're like, oh, that's where it comes from. So it's
how old are they?
The kids I've been talking to are between 5 to 9 years old.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Need more Tyrus in this world.
Honestly, we do.
They aren't aware because they are. But one of the things I notice is that a lot of what they think solutions to the climate crisis are, it's very like technologically based. So they're like, are we going to come out with a machine that will take all the plastic out of the ocean? And I was like, I mean, there are, but I was like, that really won't. I have to explain why cleanups aren't enough. It's because these people are still making a lot of plastic. You know what I mean? Yeah, and I think that's just also because the conversation around plastic pollution, what we see is like single-use plastic bags, straws, things like that, which is still obviously important. But I think we kind of have to expand or in terms of what or how much the plastic pollution crisis encompasses a lot of other things or how it's related to other things.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the trajectory I'd like to go on for the talks with the kids, because yeah, they really are aware of it. They just don't know how it connects to a lot of things.
So what advice do you usually give these children?
Like, the my number one thing is I'm like, talk to your family and talk to your friends.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Aww. I was like, I'm always like, real change starts with you. And I was like, we can continue. I was like, obviously try to reduce your plastic waste and clean up when you can, but I was like, real change comes when you try to change also like the what your family thinks, what your friends think, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, like lifestyle changes mm-hmm. make a huge difference.
Yeah. And so yeah, like I guess I'll announce it here, but I'm planning on writing a children's book about plastic pollution.
Oh wow.
That's why I started to do
this. You heard
talks.
It here first, guys.
You heard it.
Exclusive
plug. Yeah, I'm still in like the research phase, but that's kind of my goal for this book. It's like, I want to be able to extend the conversation rather than just like pick up your trash or use a metal straw. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I really want to try to bring the conversation to like, oh, holding companies accountable, but for kids.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That needs to be talked about more. Because mm-hmm. if wow. I knew this when I was a kid, if I knew that recycling was kind of fake,
Yeah, or like it's literally just the tip of the iceberg in terms yeah. of like being sustainable. Wow, that's amazing. Like how do you envision to like translate these hard facts into like digestible terms that children would understand? Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know even like I don't know if even that's just gonna cater to kids, because like a lot of people that we've been getting about our podcast is kind of like, what is a easy, digestible, convenient way to learn? Because we started this podcast because we knew a lot of the people in our own circles mm-hmm. weren't really aware or didn't know the extent to the crisis, and were so overwhelmed that they didn't know where to start. So this is kind of like our way to help bridge that gap. Ooh. I think I've said that. That's why I think that book could benefit more than just little kids. Like I think even
it's a movement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hope
I would
so.
Buy it.
Thanks, girl.
I would buy it. Sign me up on the wait list.
Yeah, put us up on pre-orders.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I really want it to be, I want it to be both in Tagalog and English, because I feel
that would be great.
I feel like I don't want it to be some like elitist whatever, and it's just in English where only like people from like IS or like BSM,
because yeah.
can, like, you know what I mean? When the people who need to learn about it are like, you know, kids or fisher folk, things like that. So that's where the research comes in. But that's what I'm trying to do with all these talks. I'm trying to see what these kids relate to and how they process it the best. Mm. And what actions they're actually willing to take. Because I can tell them like, you go through like a zero waste lifestyle, but then again, they're like six, you know? Like,
yeah. It's hard. It's hard to give concrete solutions.
Yeah,
at that
exactly.
age.
Yeah.
Like menstrual cups wouldn't even like apply to them like at that age, like it's too young.
Also another thing is that they actually aren't aware of like the solutions that are being put in place, because I feel like all they're being exposed to is like, oh, turtles are dying because of straws.
Yeah.
But actually
the call to action is not like specified.
Speaking of zero waste, I remember that you did like a zero waste challenge for a year. And I guess kind of to wrap things up together and go on to our last question that we like to ask all our guests, how can we turn this world around? What are some changes you've made in your own life? Anything, and feel free to start with like smaller changes and then talk. I'm sure people would love to hear too about your experience of being zero waste. Was it easy? Was it super hard? Like it was like one little plastic bag.
one little plastic bag the whole year.
Yeah, I fit all my waste into like a Lululemon like bag
for a whole year. 1 year in a Lululemon bag.
Yeah.
Wow.
But if you guys are what we did after with that plastic is that you can actually send it to this company called TerraCycle. And their thing is they recycle everything. And I know I just said that recycling is fake, but it also makes me feel better, because I'm not just like dumping it into, you know, whatever. They actually send it out to other companies to upcycle.
I think recycling is like, recycling isn't the final solution. Recycling should be like the last resort. It's like once you do everything else, like minimize your plastic, your consumption, like have other companies like be aware of, you know, their plastic impact. Recycling has to be like the last.
Yeah.
Like, effort. It can't be the first, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed, dude. One Lululemon bag is like pretty
wild. The whole year.
It was a lot easier to do it in the States. I wouldn't have been able to do it in the Philippines, because where I live in Bushwick, it's close to a zero waste grocery.
And we
do not have those here. And it was a zero waste grocery, not just for dry goods. It was like I could get veggies, I could get like ice cream, I could get like kombucha and just like refill it in my, like, yeah. And I don't know if they're doing it now, but they actually use TerraCycle for the things that they do get in plastic. So they're really like they're really reducing their waste, and all of their stuff is local. So what people can do is just more than just going zero waste. I think the first step is really just learning more, especially in the context of where you live or what actions you can do. For example, like me learning about going zero waste in the Philippines looks completely different from learning how to go zero waste in the States, because it's so hard here.
Yeah.
Especially when we're in lockdown, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think, one, just educating yourself, and also try to broaden the sources you get your information from. So I always try to be like, how many white environmental people are you following versus people of color? You know what I mean? Mm. And is it only just like big accounts and not like the smaller people? And obviously that comes with like them not being amplified or them not being talked about by media.
But
I think actively trying to find these people does a lot. And also, one, joining groups. Does not have to be XR, but I mean, if you want, put it in.
I just signed up on the news. I just signed up on their website.
Yay!
And they have so many events.
Yeah.
Like almost every day.
Yeah, I really want XR to grow and become like that eventually, but it's just really hard now because we can't do anything physically. Mm-hmm. But other than educating yourself, I mean, I'm really hesitant when I say try to reduce your meat or seafood intake, because for some people it's really just not.
Yeah, I guess asterisk.
Sustainable, or they can't. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have the option.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about the same thing too. Like, if it's even like when you plan out your groceries, if you can make the choice to lessen red meat or choose seafood instead, or whatever it is, it's just smaller adjustments to your lifestyle. Like, I significantly cut my meat intake since college, and I was like the biggest carnivore ever. Eventually, now I don't look for it as much. I didn't do it 360. I didn't do it completely out because I didn't think that was sustainable for my lifestyle. But then it got easier and easier to kind of balance it out.
Yeah, like I'm not even vegan or vegetarian. I still eat fish because, I mean, I'll get sick if I don't eat any kind of, like, because I'm anemic, right? So it does not make sense for me to go vegetarian or vegan. A lot of it, I think, is just reducing your consumption, like, point blank. Not, obviously not in terms of food, but like for like clothing, let's say, or like home goods, things like that. A lot of people in the zero waste movement are like, oh, you need to replace your utensils, like a wooden like spoon, fork, bring that around. And I'm like, you don't even need to buy that, just bring your utensils around. Like, why do you need to buy something else? And like, you don't even know where that wood is sourced from, you know? Yeah. And even like with clothes, even if a brand is like considered sustainable, and obviously I'm a fashion student, I love dressing up, but I think there's also value in like not giving into the culture of like, you know, like rewear your outfits. You don't need to, you know what I mean? Like keep buying something just because it says it's sustainable.
Yeah.
And that leads me to my point about like the whole local and sustainability thing. Just because it's local, just because someone says that they're local does not mean that they're sustainable, because their materials could be sourced from China. Their stuff could be sourced from China.
Yes.
But it's a local brand. Or from Bangladesh, even, where workers' rights are not
non-existent.
Yeah, non-existent. Just try to clock yourself. Try to like call yourself out for, I guess, like unsustainable practices, or even the media or information you're consuming. Yeah, just broaden it.
Yeah, it's not like sustainability can just be one thing, and it's not like, you know, like just because you buy like outfits that say they're sustainable, it doesn't mean that you are sustainable, because it's like sustainability, I feel like, is a mindset more than a product. Because like you can buy
like
a ton of products and like that, and they could be sustainable, but the way that you're purchasing it could like be the opposite. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if you're like, I remember I kind of had that mentality too. I was like, oh no, I have like all of this plastic and I have to get rid of it and replace it with all of these like eco-friendly things. And I was like, yeah, that's even more wasteful if I throw this stuff away and buy new stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with like sustainability and zero waste stuff now, is that I feel like a lot of it is really unnecessary. So they're trying to promote like all of these like reusable things when you could just use things that you already have.
Yeah. Actually, there was this one.
Or buy secondhand.
Yeah. There was this one episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. I mean, that's nowhere near a source for sustainable content. But they were like, dude, me too. The one about the straw, where they were bashing on, like, they were like, it's literally just a few inches from your mouth. Like, why don't you just drink and not use a straw? Like, and I was like, yeah.
That was good. I mean, I feel like there's still value in like reducing your plastic, reducing your meat consumption, but really, everyone can do something, like individually change something, but that's still not enough to fight the climate crisis. It makes a difference, which makes me feel better. For example, like when I'm forced to use plastic, I in my head I'm just like, oh fuck the fossil fuel industry, like I literally hate you. Like you're the reason why I have to do this.
Well, this is more so now. Super informative, and I had such a good time like learning from you. Expected. Well, thanks for coming on, Tara.
Thank you, guys.
This was awesome. Thank you so much for your time and your thoughts and your amazing mind. And for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
Check out Extinction Rebellion's page. What's the IG handle, Tara?
Extinction Rebellion PH.
And if you want to plug anything else, feel free.
I started this art account. I'm donating 50%. I'm making these drawings. I'm donating 50% to efforts to free Luma 26. Because they're still they're still in prison and they're not getting any like hygiene supplies, medicine, nothing. So I'm really trying to help them out, because Lumas are actually their biggest indigenous group and they're the ones who are fighting to protect their national resources. So I don't know why our government's going against them, but there you go.
All right.
Yeah, it's called compulsive coloring on Insta.
Thanks everyone. We're Earth friends and the Earth is our friend.